We are Vineyard.
Somos Viña.
We are Vineyard.
The Desert Mothers and Fathers, for those who don't know, they were like the earliest Christian monks. They talked about this kind of experience, this middle experience of faith, when faith feels unfulfilling or this sort of struggle with, they called it aridity, like the desert of our lives. Not necessarily like the valley of the shadow of death, not like darkness, but also not experiencing like joy and freedom and liberation and beauty at every minute. Being at the times, you're so immersed in the culture wars. Mm. And these were just so far out of the culture wars. They were out of the culture. They were 1700 year old text, you know, and these were men and women who just did long to follow Jesus and were just like wholeheartedly seeking Jesus in ways that, you know, I never will. Just giving their lives to seeking Jesus in beautiful ways.
Welcome to the We Are Vineyard podcast, conversations to help us grow with Jesus and each other. This season, we have a number of incredible guests lined up for you, and we're excited to let you know that this season's episodes will also be available as videos. So subscribe on YouTube so you never miss an episode. On today's episode, Caleb Maskell talks with Tish Harrison Warren, an author and Anglican priest. Let's listen in.
Tish Warren, as I live and breathe, what a surprise to see you here.
So good to see you.
It is great to see you. Thank you so much. You know, you were not the first We Are Vineyard podcast, but you were among the first, and you were definitely the first one that was more than 3 hours long. I think the podcast that we recorded when Jay and I came down to see you at your house in Texas was the longest podcast we ever recorded.
And it was so epic. I mean, I was living on my parents' land at the time, and so we got to hang out and be on this large expanse of land out in the country. It felt like a retreat.
It was very cool.
But was recorded.
It was like a recorded retreat. And who wouldn't want to listen to such thing? You have a new book, though.
I do.
What Grows in Weary Lands on Christian Resilience. When did the book come out?
May 12th.
Okay, so just a few days ago. Obviously an important topic, obviously a topic that comes from your heart. Why don't we just start here? Why don't you tell the story of how you came to write a book about Christian resilience, and why did you call it What Grows in Weary Lands?
Yeah, it's funny. If you would have said 5 years ago, actually 5 years ago, I think I did have a conversation with you about what book I should write next, and it was less than 5 years ago, but around then. And this was not one of the topics that I brought up. I think if you said random resilience, I would have been like, that sounds incredibly boring. So it surprises me, but it began just in my own story. And I wrote for the New York Times for 2 years on faith in public discourse and private life.
That sounds very important. Like really important. Did you feel important while you were doing it?
I did feel important. Maybe that was not great. But I also felt very, it was just both, you know, like you would meet people. Anytime people asked me what I did, they would be like, oh, nobody does that anymore. But also there was lots of people that, you know, disagreed with things. I got a ton of, so there were big fans is the point, but there were also big, what's the opposite of fans?
Detractors, yeah. Resistance.
I don't want to say anyone that disagrees with me is an enemy, and that because there were people that disagreed and did so kindly, and that was great, but there were lots of intense, I mean, there was threats, harm wished on my children.
Oh my gosh, how terrible.
Yeah, curses pronounced. I can say that to the Vineyard people. There were. It was bad. It was a bad scene.
Totally.
So I do, I do think I have, like, I know this is the word I'm about to use is overused, but I do think there was some low key trauma that accompanied it too. So it did feel important, but it also felt difficult. It wasn't like important and, you know, just a big celebration of and party or something. So it was, so I did that. And it was really, really hard to choose to leave that because I did love it in a lot of ways. I did. And it was such a rare opportunity that, I mean, even still to this day, I'm like, I don't know, maybe I should say it was a rare opportunity.
That yeah, said, it's a big deal.
You know, when I started at the times, Gus, our youngest, was not, he was only one. He was 1 year old. And so it was I had, you know, three kids, a mom with dementia and a big job. And that was its own kind of hard. Then also, it does something to you to write in such a big, to so many people, many of who do not share your priors, week in and week out about God. I think it changes the spiritual life, partly just because I was tired and I, you know, it was there's a lot of production. The first year I wrote 48 out of 51 weeks.
Oh my gosh, that is so much.
It was a lot. But then on top of that, there's just, it's a very different experience than like preaching, where people are there to like, sort of like they're there to be edified. They're presumably, they're not going to be like, why is she talking about God? You know, which they in the New York Times kind of are. And so not everyone, but there are certainly readers that are like, this, why is this even being talked about in the paper record? So, when I left, it was a hard decision, but I was worn out. I was physically worn out. I was creatively, like writing wise, pretty worn out, but also, spiritually, like I think and I do not think it was just because of the times, but I think I had hit a place in my relationship with Jesus where things felt dry and where God felt distant. I felt disoriented. The church sort of nationally was struggling, but that was working its way out in the local level in my life and in difficult and painful ways. Mm-hmm. So I was disoriented about my relationship with church and God, and things felt hard. Like marriage felt hard. Relationships felt hard. Friendships felt hard. So, So I was going to write a different book. And in the middle of that, I mean, I was just like, how do I keep, I was in a place where I felt like God feels distant. I told my husband, like in prayer, it felt like the line had gone dead. And I want to keep going, but I don't know how to keep going. And I was in this kind of place. I couldn't plot it on a map. So Stanley Hauerwas talks about learning to how to go on when you don't know where you are. And so I was in this place where I didn't really know where I was creatively, spiritually, emotionally. And so I didn't know how to keep going. And I certainly didn't know how to keep growing, in the middle of that. And so, I ended up turning to what I know, which is like the historic church and learning from the past. And as I read through the great tradition of faith, I saw this kind of experience of where I describe it in the book as a void between depression and flourishing. Like, I wasn't depressed. There wasn't a great grief or tragedy. This wasn't like profound suffering, but I wasn't flourishing either. Yeah. It was a bit of a midlife crisis and certainly kind of a big mid-faith crisis.
Tell me, what kind of ministry stuff were you doing? It might be good to remind people that you are also an Anglican priest alongside being a writer. So this crisis you're describing probably has like a bit of a weekly dimension as well in terms of your kind of role at your church, or not so much?
Well, it because this is many years we're talking about, it changed.
Yeah.
So when I was at the New York Times, I wasn't doing a lot at my local church week to week. I just didn't have capacity. That was actually partly why I left. I remember there was one time I was like writing some piece about the church, who's really like exultant and idealistic about like the church is this community that is a where people are known and we know people by name and we love our neighbors. And I had a friend that was sick and I wanted to bring them soup. And I couldn't. I didn't have time. And I thought I'm writing about how the church needs to care for our neighbors, and I don't have time to go actually care for my actual neighbor, because I'm like casting this vision, this big national vision that is keeping me from like living this and actually like bringing my friend the soup. So I wasn't. And then in the middle, I was in this time of burnout, I left the Times, and 2 weeks later, like kind of, this is, I don't think this is how it works at the Vineyard. So, and it doesn't even really work like this in Anglicanism very often, but our bishop called us on the phone and essentially asked us if we would take over this community of people that wanted to worship together. So basically he asked us, would you plant a church?
Yeah.
So it's a much longer story than that, but we ended up completely unexpectedly. I say a baby was left on our doorstep and the baby was the church. But 2 weeks after I left the Times, we planted a church. So that's about 2.5 years old now.
I'm just imagining this conversation. Baby. Bishop Todd calls you up.
Yeah, we were actually on vacation. He
calls you up on vacation. He's called me on vacation as well, as it happens. I was actually sitting in a bar in Estes Park with my wife on our anniversary, and I had just ordered a drink, which was called a cocktail called the Bishop.
No.
And the only reason I answered the phone was because I had just ordered the Bishop, and literally seconds later, Bishop Todd Hunter called
That's
me. And
crazy.
So I worked for Bishop Todd Hunter on my wedding anniversary for about 10 minutes, because it just felt like this has got to be Providence. So he calls you up and he says, now you have margin because you've quit the New York Times. Perhaps you would like to plant a church. And you're like, dude, he said,
there's
exhausted.
These people. Because our church was born somewhat out of a church split.
Okay.
And so there were folks that chose to left the ACNA because they had changed theologically on a number of things. And these were the like stayers, the remainers, who'd been worshiping. Some of them had been worshiping together for like 7 years. And they were like, these people want to keep worshiping together. And
you said, yes,
you're the priest that lives in the same part of town as them. And
Amen.
There's no one else that does. So
that's right.
Would you take over? At first it was like 12 weeks. Could you take over for 12 weeks and love this discernment period?
Yeah.
There was never a discernment period. After,
you're
like,
still doing it, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So in the middle of all that, things are going, are you asking yourself, am I burned out? Or you're basically saying, why do I feel like I don't know what to do now?
Yeah, I was somewhat asking myself, am I burned out? But burnout to me seems like such a occupational therapy buzzword. I mean, burnout was for like, you know, people that work in offices and work 100-hour weeks and corporate executives that don't take a Sabbath. I mean, I had taken a Sabbath for 20 years.
Right.
I was supposed to feel burned out, right? Mm-hmm. Like I had done the thing. I prayed. I had work-life balance. It was more like, why does God feel distant? Why does everything feel so heavy and hard? Why do I feel so tired? all the time. And it felt more than like physical tiredness. It wasn't just like, maybe I need more iron or vitamin D. Why do I feel like off my game in such a profound way? And, things that seemed joyful to me, like writing, or, you know, no longer do, which I know if someone's listening, they're like, that sounds like depression, which to some, I was in therapy. We were doing the test, and maybe it was on the borderline of depression, but it wasn't, because there were other things I did find joy in. But I didn't have a lot of space or time for those things that I found joy in. So I was writing this other book, but I felt like, man, I don't know how to keep going in my Christian life. And I came on these resources from the church. And I feel like there's a book. A book arises in my imagination when three things come together. My own struggle of I'm trying to figure something out. For me, like what I believe, what I'm like, how do I live the Christian life? How do I apprentice Jesus in this? So there's like that. I usually write books out of things that I'm struggling with, not the things that I've like nailed or like figured out. So that, but then I need to look around and see it in the culture that this is meeting like something that's happening beyond me. So this isn't just like Tish's personal experiences, which I have lots of. Mm-hmm. Many of don't end up in print. But this is a broader cultural phenomenon. So that was the second thing, is like I felt all of a sudden like it didn't seem like it was just executives that were like, the New York Times was talking about like things like marital burnout and parenting burnout. And the idea of languishing was happening. Like people, friends were sending around memes. I had people in ministry context and pastoral context just constantly be telling me, you know, that they felt exhausted. And so I just was seeing this kind of everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's when my experience meets a cultural experience and then meets a structure. There has to be like some kind of, there has to be a structure that's exciting to me that makes me want to write it. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I would be like, you know, I tell writers this all the time. If you have an idea that you're passionate about, but not a structure that demands the written word, then do a podcast or do a blog series. Like, you don't have to write a book, but the structure was running into these desert mothers and fathers and feeling like I really, these are like interesting. So the desert mothers and fathers, for those who don't know, they were like the earliest Christian monks, 3rd through the 5th century, super weird, super wild, but they talked about this kind of experience, this middle experience of faith, when faith feels unfulfilling, or this sort of struggle with, they called it aridity, like the desert of our lives, not necessarily like the valley of the shadow of death, not like darkness, but also not experiencing like joy and freedom and liberation and beauty at every minute. And so
That's the place you were in when you started to write.
Yeah.
You had gotten to a place where you felt, I think the word you used was aridity or dryness. And you're like, I've been doing everything I'm supposed to do. I'm a freaking priest. I love my family. I pray. I love Jesus. And yet somehow things don't feel right.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that, you discover the desert fathers and mothers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had read The Desert Mothers and Fathers before briefly in seminary, but it was like, I got real into them. Yeah. I couldn't.
I got weird about it.
I'm still weird about it. I love them so much. And I still am coming across things. There's a story I read in the last 2 weeks that I didn't put in the book because I hadn't read it. And I love it so much. I like want to recall the book so I can put the story back in. But I there are certainly things in the Desert Fathers and Mothers I'm like, that is whack, and I don't know what to do with that theologically. So if someone just puts something up at random, like a random unedited edition, they may be like, what is she talking about? But so there are some crazy stuff in there. But there is also just so much humanity and so much And the other thing I loved, they're for being like the foundation of Christian spirituality, of practice, of monastic practice, they're strangely non-didactic. They like speak almost in story. They almost always speak in stories or parables or metaphors. Mm. And
like Jesus.
Yeah, that's true. So it's just, I was being at the Times, you're so immersed in the culture wars. Mm. And these were just so far out of the culture wars. They were out of the culture. They were 1700 year old text, you know, and these were men and women who just did long to follow Jesus and were just like wholeheartedly seeking Jesus in ways that, you know, I never will, just giving their lives to seeking Jesus in beautiful
ways. So one of the questions that I have for you, which is a question that I have kind of just in the world right now, because there is a bit of a sense of retrieval of things like monasticism. I mean, Jared Boyd has done this wonderful work of retrieval. We see that some in Practicing the Way type stuff as well. And, you know, there are different places where retrieval is happening. One of the questions that I have for you and just is constantly coming up for me is, why do we have to go so far back? Like, why do we have to go so far out of our own culture in order to get these things? And I think there's maybe a bigger arc to that question about, well, what would we say now that we've remembered these things? But part of what I'm hearing you say is what was helpful about going to the desert with the Desert Mothers and Fathers is to be so far out of the normal discourse of like left versus right,
yep,
or like conservative versus progressive, or orthodox versus whatever the non-orthodox thing is in the church, right? I mean, it sounds like they just pulled you out of a binary,
yes,
into a place where what's happening? What is it?
They are seeking God it's a radically different culture and radically different language and radically different way of perceiving the world, but they're pursuing the same God. And so they defy all current categories because of that. Mm. And so, that was helpful. I don't know if we have to, there are of course contemporary voices that you could, I mean, Dallas Willard is, but part of this for me, I think there's a couple of things. It's that they're radically out of the culture, outside the culture wars. So they don't represent like a tribe. Or they're not, you know, mm-hmm, like they're not,
sure,
they don't have a Substack. They're not trying to get published. They're not trying to be remembered. Like, there is something really beautiful about their faith was just so non-commercial and it was beautiful, right, like humble.
Even if they wanted to be famous then, it's way too late. They just are what they are at this point.
They were kind of early spiritual celebrities and they hated it. They kept moving away farther to try to get away from people who kept coming to them and like asking for advice and prayer. And they were like, I really want to be by myself, guys. Like, if you didn't take the hint because I moved into a cave in the desert, like. But the other thing I think is that there's something, you know, a few things. Number one, I think there's, you know, the Reformation motto, ad fontes, go to the source. There's, when we're talking about doctrine, we think of the source, well, the Bible. Okay, I'm talking to vineyard. The source is the Bible. But in terms of humans, we think about like the church fathers, like the creeds, like the great, like these are like, you know, Athanasius. He like was, you know, helped us, like he stood against heresy and he was like the source of Christian doctrine and God used him in that way.
And now we have the Nicene Creed and that's a good thing and we build on it.
Right.
Right.
The desert. So, to fully understand, you know, doctrine, what we believe, it like helps to go back to these sources and read what they were arguing about and thinking. The desert fathers and mothers were not the source of doctrine. A lot, they don't spend a lot of time doing doctrinal debates. They're the source, in my mind, of Christian practice. Like the kinds of rhythms and practices, even the concept, I mean, the rule of life, like the Benedictine rule of life. Benedict was reading these guys, was super influenced by the desert mothers and fathers. So all of kind of Western, like Christian monastic practice flows from this kind, their sort of community. And I'm not saying they're the first. Obviously, they drew a lot from Jewish practice, but they're a huge. They're like if the fathers are the fathers of doctrine, the desert fathers and mothers are the fathers of practice. And I wasn't so much like doubting the Trinity. I was like, how do I deal with resentment in my life? How do I deal with anger in my life? How do I deal with like the fact that I'm like you said, doing the things and have been doing them for a long time. And I'm not at the beginning of my faith, but I don't feel like I've reached like heroic guru status.
Not even close, sadly, it's perhaps.
It's, you know what, Caleb, you were a huge part of this. And I haven't gotten to talk to you about this, but it was our conversation about Martin Shaw's Black, White, and Red. And
isn't like, that great stuff? Yeah.
Yes. And which is, he writes about that in Liturgies of the Wild, his book that recently came out. But the idea of it's the red. That it's the, which is, it represents like youth and passion and fervor and being on fire, like being on fire for Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have white, which is like wisdom. This is like the saints entering glory at the end of their life. And I think we have like some heroes with this.
Yeah, they become sages.
Yeah, it's like Tim Keller, Eugene Peterson, Fleming Rutledge. Who is it in the vineyard? I don't know.
John Wimber, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Wimber. Like the people who like live their life faithfully, they're sages. But there's this middle section of the black, of like, how do you get from the red? You don't get from the red to the white without going through this black, which is the struggle, the time where it feels like, Martin Shaw, who wrote about this, is like the fires of your life have burned down.
Yes.
But you're not like a guru yet. It's Gandalf's struggle with the Balrog. It's that like, whatever that is, it's like wrestling with your internal life. You're in the sins that dog us and keep dogging us. The loneliness we feel, the disappointment we feel in what we thought our life would be, the disappointment we feel in God, like these, and but you, I say in the book, like you cannot get from newness and exuberance to like wisdom without the middle.
Yeah.
And this, but I don't think the church or the culture, either the secular culture or the church, does a good job of telling these middle stories. And so part of this book was my own just sense of just deep desire to tell middle stories, to tell, what does it mean not to come to Jesus or to be at the end of our life as the guru looking back, but like to return to Jesus, to kick again and again and again and again over a lifetime.
It totally makes sense. right? Because we do celebrate the passion of youth, and we do learn, I think, retrospectively, to celebrate the wisdom that comes to us from sage types. But I think often, especially in like the world that I inhabit, where, you know, there's an enthusiasm for church planting, for giving your whole life, for being wholly surrendered, you come to Jesus and you think like, okay, now you write the new script for my life and so on. For a lot of people, that really does originate from passion and zeal and fervor. And the scripture is so clear that you don't quench the zeal of the young, but what the zeal will lead you to, and I think this is what Martin Shaw is talking about in that sort of archetypal passage from the red through the black to the white, is that your zeal leads you on a downward journey. Right? Just like Henry Nouwen says, right? Like the Godward way is the downward way. And that downward way sounds like fine, but when you're in the middle of it, it's dying. And as I read your book, and as I've lived, a bit, and maybe, I think, you know, I'm 48. I think you're in your 40s. Like there's a way in which the challenge just of living, plus the challenge of living and bearing witness to future hope in the midst of complicated, compromised now, is just hard. And it feels like dying. And you are saying in your book, you have this line, submit to the discipline of the desert. And it feels like when you say that, you are speaking the wisdom of the desert fathers and mothers to people in that middle section, and you say to them, you can either flame out, numb out, or go deep. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
What does it mean to flame out, numb out, or go deep? And then when we're going deep, like, where are we going?
Yeah. So flame out, numb out, go deep. That was just a literal phrase that my husband and I would like say to each other sometime, or we would use it offhandedly, like, oh, I mean, he flamed out or he numbed out or like, so it became, it really just grew out of our own conversations that when life keeps going and it's hard, particularly maybe people middle life, which I'll just take 30 to 60. When you experience more of the suffering in the world and of your own, in your own heart, that there are often three responses that you flame out, numb out, or go deep. Mm-hmm. And flaming out are the, there's different ways this looks that we have been in ministry. My husband is also a pastor, and we have been in ministry a long time. And you begin to see, I mean, we have now multiple stories of priests who have affairs, who,
get like, stuck in some terrible way.
Exactly. End up, slaves to addiction. And that is like flaming out. It's kind of it's the ways where people blow up their lives on purpose. Like, and it's usually a response to pain. You know, they're in pain. Yeah. They don't know how to handle it. And they just, and they explode their lives. And it usually causes a lot of collateral damage. A lot of people hurt or churches hurt or whatever. But it's also scandals. I mean, it's the things we talk about are people like really publicly deconstructing and really big leaving loud kind of ways.
Your comment about on purposeness is really interesting there, because often those things can be framed as a mistake, right? Because they're a journey off of the narrow way for someone who's in ministry and even just someone who's trying to follow Jesus. But what's interesting there, you're talking about flaming out. It's a response often to pain.
Yeah.
It's just the wrong kind of response.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then, but also I think there is a kind of like genre of literature for women my age that's in the culture of this sort of like, you get to midlife and things fill off and you leave your husband, you go to like, I don't know, like India or Tibet and you like, you know, go
you
through,
eat,
or
you pray, like, you meet, love that kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, exactly. Or you like, meet someone at hot yoga and like sure. your life starts over. It's a reinvention story.
Right.
We love reinvention stories.
Mm.
So there's that flaming out. Much more common is numb out, and it's talked about less, but it is, I think, far more what most of us do, which is that so it's not the couple that, you know, have an affair, but it's the couple that just give up on the idea of being healthy and well, and just like slowly settle for resentment over time. It's like the little addictions. It's like the, I feel pain in my life and don't know how to deal with it, so I'm going to like get really into sports gambling, or like watch Netflix all the time, or like be addicted to shopping, or like, I mean, to some extent, we all flame out, we all numb out, and hopefully by God's grace, we go deep. Like I'm not saying like, those are the ones, but it's the people that it is the struggle that in all of our souls to fill our lives up with creature comforts and distraction so that we are like, so it's the slow drip of morphine of American consumerism and constant digital distraction that we all could succumb to. And then there's go deep, which is to plunge ourselves deeper into the things of God, I'm going to say it because this is what I mean, is like the practice of spirituality, Christian spirituality, Christ-centered spirituality, of like deep prayer and deep engagement with the scriptures and deep engagement with our community, with the church, local church, and also the history of the church throughout time.
Yeah.
And so it's the, and then of course, to go deep into ourselves, to see, to actually notice the grief and pain that we carry and not try to just numb it out, to go deep into relationships, friendships with others and community, to be honest with people, about where we are and who we are, and then deep into grace, like deep into this, like at the end of the day, like complete lack of control that any of us have over our lives or our own salvation. Then, and like, we are plunged into the mercy and grace of God.
We Are Vineyard is grateful for the sponsors that make this podcast possible. Have you ever wished that there's a way to help the girls in your church grow in their faith while connecting to generations of women? That's the vision behind Vessels. Vessels is a place for girls in grades 3 through 6 where faith, fun, and biblical truth come together. More like a club than a classroom, it combines engaging Bible teaching, crafts, jewelry, music, and authentic relationships that help girls discover their God-given value, purpose, and identity. At the same time, Vessels creates opportunities for women and girls to build meaningful relationships across generations, strengthening both along the way. Now, personally, my daughters have absolutely loved being a part of Vessels. I've been so impressed by the depth of what they're learning each week. It's helping them build a strong foundation of following Jesus, memorizing scriptures, and discovering who God made them to be. Vessels clubs launch each fall, which means now is the perfect time to explore bringing a club to your church. To learn more about Vessels and what it looks like to launch a club in your community, visit godsvessels.com and schedule a conversation. That's godsvessels.com. The next generation won't be discipled by accident. Let's be intentional. Do you ever feel just scattered? Whether you're an established church or just starting out, Planning Center helps you connect every ministry and sync every detail. From volunteer schedules and kids check-ins to donations and event signups, then you can feel at ease knowing things are in their right place. Get started for free today at planningcenter.com. What if the communities you're building could only be as healthy as you are? Better Together is back, and this year we're going deeper. Join Vineyard USA Associations July 21st through 23rd at North Jersey Vineyard for a transformational gathering where beloved community meets emotionally healthy leadership. Featuring Drew Hyun from Emotionally Healthy Discipleship, you'll discover how to lead from wholeness instead of woundedness and build communities where people don't just attend, they truly belong. This isn't just another conference. It's a reset for your soul and a vision for the community God's called you to lead. Early bird pricing is available through May 4th, so don't wait. Learn more and register today at bettertogether.vineyardusa.org. We'll see you there.